lifestyle design, accelerated learning, optimized self-improvement. I've been fascinated by all this stuff. It's almost core to me, this idea that I can improve in anything I want. For example, I get stronger, become a better writer, be more successful in my career, just by working smart. That I don't need superhuman genes to achieve superhuman results. Perhaps no one embodies this philosophy more than Tim Ferriss. The guy has mastered skills ranging from Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, language learning, tango dancing, to writing bestsellers, angel investing, and now releasing his first show, which launches today. I've adopted some of his and others' frameworks as it relates to career, my passions, hobbies, and I've had awesome results. But when I look at my life, when I think about what I've been most proud of, when I felt most fulfilled, it isn't exactly those things. It's my deepest friendships, my relationships, the rooting of myself in communities, things that don't exactly lend themselves to optimizing, or at least as clearly. Now, Tim's not just a radical optimizer. He has a lot of fascinating thoughts about success management, meditation, self-reflection, being content. Tim has really studied and is dedicated to living the good life on his terms. So my question to him, to everyone on this episode, is this concept of deconstructed learning, of lifestyle design, to what extent, if any, does it apply to deep friendships, romantic relationships, fatherhood, being a good person? And how so? If these are the most important things in our lives, how should we allocate resources accordingly to becoming better at them? What does lifestyle design look like in the context of all this? We don't exactly answer this question, but we take a stabs at it. And maybe this is a preview of a future book where Tim deconstructs friendships, relationships, parenting, with the same dedication that he puts into his many other experiments. Or at least that's what I hope anyway. Then again, who knows? Maybe it's better to looking at these things from a different lens entirely. I don't know, man. What I do know is that this was a really fun talk. All right, here's Tim. You're about to release this show in a few days.
I am. And hopefully by the time people are listening to this, they'll actually be able to check it out. It's been a real uphill battle.
This has been years.
It's been at least a year and a half, 2 years in the making. And what I'm excited about with the show, which is the Tim Ferriss Experiment, is that, number one, I was really able to cherry pick what I wanted to do. And I said no to a lot of television over the years because it was always, hey, we want you to do the 4-hour workweek lifestyle makeover of the Real Housewives of Sacramento or whatever. And it was not of interest. Great way to destroy a reputation that you spent a long time trying to build and protect. But the opportunity came about. I was chatting with Turner Broadcasting, really good guy named Chris Vivian at the time, and he asked me the question nobody had asked me, which was, if you could do anything on television, what would you want to do? And I was like, ah, well, that's a new approach. And I said, there are a few ideas. Number one is a show about really extreme accelerated learning, kind of like Mythbusters meets Jackass, where I test this toolkit of accelerated learning with notoriously punishing skills like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or surfing and three-gun shooting, tactical shooting, et cetera. And then the second idea was a show about becoming Jason Bourne, because I have this infatuation, this obsession with the first Bourne Identity movie especially. And number three, I said, only if I can work with someone who's made TV that I want to watch. And I brought up a production company called 0.0, who made all of Anthony Bourdain's stuff and still does. Very gritty, super cinematic, very kinetic. They have a very particular shooting style that is very hard to do. And in the end, we were able to do all three basically at once and wrap that together for the show. And we made the show, filmed 13 episodes over something insane like 16 weeks. And I suffered a lot of injuries. I mean, incredible number of injuries, which are all caught on camera, which I guess is a good thing. And the content got orphaned. And what that means, this happens a lot in music, TV, film, almost any type of creation. Books happens also, where the division at Turner Broadcasting went out of business, was shut down, everyone was fired, and all of the content, so all of the shows that were made, all the online content, all the editorial, everything was just shelved and put into a vault, and it was written off. And my question was, of course, well, wait a second, like, no one's seen this stuff. We only kind of previewed one or two episodes. What about the other 11? What about the hours and hours of bonus footage? And they're like, nope, chapter closed. I'm sorry, that's the end of the game. And so I spent the last year lawyering and negotiating and trying to craft a deal that would be remotely acceptable slash interesting to them, because it's a huge company. And whenever, let's say, you're a musician, this is very typical, where they'll stop, say, printing your record. This is back in the day. Or stop selling your music. You have an album that's just sitting kind of hostage in a vault, and they're not selling it. You're not making any money from it. None of your fans have access to it. What do you do? And what I've realized is there are a lot of really exciting options. I didn't take this particular path, but I thought about it, which was, in this day and age, you can go to, say, change.org, get a bunch of people to publicly petition to allow you to buy back the rights, right? So you're not even asking them to give it back, but you want to have a real conversation about crafting a deal to get back the rights. Then you could go to Kickstarter with the same email list from change.org and raise money to get that deal done. So you could be a so-called starving artist and still rescue your orphan content. And I just think of all of the amazing TV shows, movies, albums that have never seen the light of day. So I'm hoping that this launch will be a case study. It'll become a proof point where people are like, holy shit, I didn't realize I could fucking do that. And they'll sort of dust off this enthusiasm that they had for something they really put their heart and soul into, and put them out into the world. So that's kind of how it came together. But it's very surreal, because I, on some level, didn't expect it to happen. It's very hard to negotiate with large companies, because the general rule in negotiation is he or she who cares the least wins. And it was a rounding error of a rounding error for them to do anything with this show. Even though it represented, for me, a small fortune to try to get it back, it was just not a high priority in the grand scheme of things, which is totally understandable. You know, it'd be like someone coming to me and being like, hey, I want to, you know, license your content and give you $15 a month. I'd be like, not interesting, you know, I'm sorry. And it was the equivalent for them. So it's very surreal and unexpected that it finally happened.
And as someone who's obsessed with, you know, yourself, with meta learning, with improvement, it must have been so frustrating to kind of deal with this bureaucratic, just kind of ridiculousness.
It was a very hard process, but what I realized is it's easy for me to take things personally, and it's a bad habit, but I'm very aggressive, I'm very particular and impatient, and that doesn't always gel well with other people, understandably. I mean, I'm not the easiest person to work with. But what I initially attributed to, like, oh my God, I can't believe this person won't help me with this, or that person will help me with that, is it's very easy to blame the person. But if you look at the architecture of a large company, you just have to understand that they're doing their job, and humans respond to incentives. And that's like economics at work. And that applies within companies as well. So I had to really take a step back and be like, all right, let me understand exactly what they're trying to do, what they're tasked with doing, and figure out how to craft a deal that will allow everyone to not lose face and have this thing do well, hopefully. That is particularly challenging in, say, whether it's movie studios or TV, whenever there's a regime change, what happens, and this is not exactly what happened in my case, but it happens a lot, where, say, a new CEO comes in for a given music label. Well, if he puts out an album that was from his predecessor, if it does well, he'll get none of the credit. And if it does poorly, he'll get all of the blame. And so they just go, you know what? The best decision here is to not do anything with this. And it happens a lot. So it's very, very challenging. And I would say people mistakenly believe that agents run Hollywood. And I think that agents can be very impactful. I don't currently have an agent. But the lawyers really seem to be ultimately the people who kick the field goal at the very end of the day.
Right.
And so I really had to get familiar with law and entertainment law, which is completely different from, say, the startup world.
Right.
It's a different beast altogether. And there isn't the same sense always, not always, but there isn't the same sense of urgency that you have in the startup game, where it's like, I have lawyers here in Silicon Valley, and I'm very involved with startups, and I can get same-day feedback.
Yeah.
It's not... Turns out that's not as common in other types of law, necessarily. So it's been a journey, but I'm very excited, and I'm also excited to just experiment with new means of launching. Quite frankly, I haven't done a big launch in a couple of years, and things have changed a lot. Yeah. The landscape has changed entirely.
Right. One thing I want to harp on, then we'll get to launch. You said you're not easy to work with. I think it's interesting because you've thought a lot about meta learning as it relates to activities, as it relates to sports, as it relates to languages, as it relates to almost everything. Have you thought about it, or how have you thought about it as it relates to kind of personality traits or things you want to improve on yourself?
This brings up a whole set of, I think, very interesting questions. One of which is how much energy and time and resources do you allocate to fixing your weaknesses versus magnifying or multiplying your strengths? Now, that can be used as a preface to say, I'm a dick and it's not worth fixing, therefore I'm just being the next Steve Jobs. That's what Steve Jobs did. And I'm not sure that's entirely fair.
Right.
But what I have realized is that there are certain aspects of myself that I want to work on. So I think my impatience is so exaggerated that it is frequently counterproductive, and I've seen that. There are other things that drive people crazy, like my degree of obsessive perfectionism. If you look at any of my drafts for my blog posts, it's like 37 to 60 revisions. I spend an incredible amount of energy on the details because I think the difference between good and great is kind of writing a book. For instance, I had someone say to me when I was writing, I think it was my last book, they said, you're 90% done. Congratulations. You only have 50% left. And I feel like the difference between being good at what you do and great is that last 10%. And it's where most people stop revising things. So that type of perfectionism drives people, a lot of people crazy, but I'm not going to change that. Because the only reason I feel like my content has had the spread that it has is because of that last 10%. And when I find someone who has the same level of OCD perfectionism, we fucking slay dragons. Right. It's incredible what we get done. And so I'm working with a guy right now named Adam who is – he's harder on himself than I could be on him.
Yeah.
And some people might think that that would lead to paralysis. But it doesn't because he's managed teams and he's built things before, and we've been able to get just an astonishing amount of high quality work done in a very compressed time frame.
Yeah.
And so I'm not going to compromise on that, right? So it's really a matter of looking at the behavior or the trait and with what frequency, right? Is it 2 out of 10 times, 8 out of 10 instances? Is it productive versus counterproductive, and then working on things accordingly. When you look at learning, I mean, a lot of so-called learning is just behavioral change. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of people listening, I'm sure, and we all suffer from this at different points, who know they want to wake up earlier, they want to be a morning person, and yet they still hit the snooze button 2, 3, 4 times. And I am guilty of that. That's one of my most challenging behavioral changes. Or they know they should floss, but they don't floss, even though it would just take 1 or 2 minutes, or lose weight, follow a diet, quit smoking, pick your behavior. So when people understand the how-to but still can't make changes, that, I think, is in some ways the crown jewel of accelerated learning, is cracking that nut and really figuring it out. And I think that if you look at the progression, it comes down to a progression, viewing learning not just in the how-to but the in what order to.
Right.
So how do you sequence things? And I'll give you an example. Josh Waitzkin, who was the inspiration for Searching for Bobby Fischer, he's considered a chess prodigy, but he's also world champion in Tai Chi push hands, first black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu under Marcelo Garcia, who's like the Michael Jordan of the sport, widely considered the best grappler to ever walk the planet. He has frameworks for learning different skills. And when I sat down with Josh, which we got on video for the Tim Ferriss experiment because he was helping me do an experiment with learning chess and jiu-jitsu in the same week, which turns out is maybe a little too much to bite off at once. But yeah, if you want to see me break a floating rib, then you can watch that episode. The way that he teaches chess is completely counter to almost any book you would ever pick up. So instead of starting you with openers, he starts with an empty board with a king and a pawn versus a king. And he teaches you broad, deep, powerful principles that then apply everywhere, not just this rote memorization of openers. And I was astonished. I was like, okay, great. This is kind of abstract, not sure how this is going to work. Went to Washington Square Park, had no right to be there at all, and lasted about 10 times longer than I should have, just with a 5 to 15 minute preview of some of these principles. And it seemed like I had tactics, but I didn't. I just had a few high-level principles. Another complementary approach would be just say, like, working on changing my behaviors. You have to have a pattern interrupt if you're changing reflexive or automatic behaviors. So for me, I do 5 minutes. I use something called the 5-minute journal in the morning and at night to basically do.
I have one in my backpack right now.
Yeah, they're great. To basically spec out my day and what behaviors I want to work on, what things I'm grateful for, et cetera. And then you do a postmortem in the evening. And there are other tools as well. So to counter my impatience, for instance, I was given a bracelet by Andrew Warner of Mixergy. And I'm holding it up here for those of you who don't have telepathy or clairvoyance. It looks like rosary beads, mm-hmm. basically. And if I feel myself getting anxious, which I know will lead to an impatient response, then I just say calm, calm, and I go through one bead at a time. And I just say that as a meditation maybe 10 times, and it's a pattern interrupt. So in the beginning, you'll get angry or impatient, and then you'll notice that you got angry or impatient, and then you'll probably get angry and impatient with yourself. And then as you continue to develop the skill, and it's a practice, really, of awareness, then you will notice you're getting angry or impatient, and you'll still get angry and impatient. And you'll display that to someone else. Then slowly you'll interrupt it. You'll prevent it from happening. And then you won't even have the impulse. And so it's sort of like progressive resistance and weight training. And if you want to floss, it's like, okay, make the commitment to floss your front two teeth. That's it. Every night, front two teeth. That's all you need to do. And it's kind of like in writing, just because I've spent so much time in that world, the best advice I ever got was not to have a really aggressive quota per day. And the goal became 2 shitty pages. That's all you need to do. Not 10 pages, not great pages, 2 shitty pages. And of course you overshoot that. Mm-hmm. Once you get over the first bump in that building of inertia where you sit down with a blank page. Like once you get started, 8 times out of 10 in my case, I would surpass the 2 pages and it wouldn't all be shitty. But even if it was shitty and I got my 2 pages out, I had one for the day and my hesitancy to face the blank page the next morning was less.
Right.
That's also why IBM, not a lot of people realize this, had one of the most effective sales forces in the world for a very long period of time. They had the lowest quotas, so that was viewed as an integral piece of the program because the salespeople were not intimidated to pick up the phone.
Mm-hmm.
They had the lowest quotas.
Wow.
Some of it's very counterintuitive.
I was going to save this question for later, but I think it's appropriate now because it's going to set the stage. Who comes to mind when you hear the word successful and why?
First person that comes to mind is Richard Feynman, who was a physicist, won the Nobel Prize at one point, also worked on the atomic bomb at Los Alamos, but was a very curious character, and that's a label that's applied to him a lot. So he was, number one, a tinkerer and explored many different areas. So he wasn't one-dimensional. He was a world-class scientist, obviously, but he was also a codebreaker, a sort of amateur but high-level cryptographer. He played the bongos. He decided he wanted to learn how to pick up women, so he started doing experiments in bars for that. He became a safe cracker.
Did the experiments with women work?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah, yeah. He wasn't very self-conscious, and he really did not. He had a very low opinion of people who were in positions of power who just wore, say, epaulets or uniforms to sort of reinforce that power, where people would accept things without questioning them. So I suppose if you were to drill down to it, I think he's a very hilarious, funny character. And one of my favorite books is called Surely You Must Be Joking, Mr. Feynman. It's just everyone listening should read this book. He loved life, enjoyed life, loved very deeply. Sad story about how he lost his true love, one of his true loves. But it was just a very well-rounded, intellectually curious human being who always questioned assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite quotes that I introduce a lot as the first slide when I give keynotes is from Mark Twain, which is, when you find yourself on the majority, it's time to pause and reflect. And I think he did that a lot. So when everyone else is saying, for instance, the Challenger disaster, when the space shuttle exploded on launch, was caused by this, this, that, or this, he was questioning all of those assumptions. It became a real thorn in the side of everyone who's trying to do the investigation, because those people didn't really want to do the investigation, or many of them. And he had some extremely interesting help, which he talked about. He talks about in the book, brilliant help from a military fellow. And he was generally not a fan of the military, but found some very interesting allies. In any case, the O-ring and the demonstration with cold water and how it shrunk at the press conference, it's just vintage Feynman. Mm-hmm. I mean, instead of burying that in 700 pages of documentation on the postmortem, he's like, okay, press conference, you want to see what happened? Here's what happened. And he drops it into the cold, you know, into the ice water. And he could take that. That's another reason that I idolize him in some ways. And he's not a perfect character. He has had his flaws. But he could take the extremely complex, say, some concept in physics, and then stab a pencil into the side of an apple and demonstrate it in 10 seconds, and everyone would get it. And he was a very popular teacher. I think he was teaching physics at Caltech at the time, where he was there for a good period of time. But Richard Feynman would be the first person that comes to mind.
And it's interesting, because when you talk about him, you talk about how he had a very full life. You brought up the example of dating. You brought up the example of losing his love. I'm curious, as someone who hack is kind of a, I'm not sure if that's the right word for it, but is obsessed with accelerated learning, meta-learning in various formats, how have you thought about it in the context of like deepest friendships or relationships, and just this general concept of big and deep love?
Well, I think that less is more in a lot of respects, and that whether or not it's with, say, thinking about so-called networking and relationships or athletic training, I heard a great quote from a track and field coach who had produced something like 17 world records from his athletes. And he said, the goal is to do the least amount necessary, not the most that is possible. And for deep friendships to exist for me, I find that I cannot have an overabundance of loose connections. If I have 100 acquaintances who are constantly, and these are quality problems to have, but they're still problems, who are, say, inviting me to coffee, to dinner, to meet their friends, making email introductions, unsolicited, hey, CC, meet my friend, oh shit, now I have an extra pen pal and, you know, 20 more email in my inbox. If you don't manage the loose ties, you will not have deep ties. And the expression, of course, here that you hear quite a bit is, you're the average of the five people you associate with most. And I believe that, and I think that you want to choose those people very, very carefully. And from a tactical standpoint, how do you choose those people? How do you find those people? There are a few very concrete ways. Number one is choosing the where of happiness, not just the what or the who. So you can choose, say, your location, like San Francisco, as I did, specifically to be exposed to those types of people. Mm-hmm. And you and I both know it's an unusual city. I mean, you can go to Sightglass Coffee or Blue Bottle Coffee or one of these retail locations, and you could have two people, each in like dirty t-shirts and torn jeans. One is a unemployed recent graduate, and the other person's a billionaire, and you have no idea. And unless you might recognize the face, but you can literally like bump into Jack Dorsey just sitting in Sightglass, like, oh, you're walking around, you bump into Peter Thiel, and that doesn't happen everywhere. But the other way for people who perhaps don't have the option of moving at the moment would be, and this is what I did when I first moved to Silicon Valley, is volunteering for organizations, sometimes nonprofits, that organize events. So what I mean by that, to give a concrete example, and I don't think they exist anymore, but I volunteered for a group called the Silicon Valley Association of Startup Entrepreneurs. These days, you could, and there was another organization that was very popular at the time called TAI, the Indus Entrepreneur. So for Indian entrepreneurs, but people of all stripes went to these events. These days, I mean, you could have, you know, the founder of this, the founder of that. There are all sorts of different startup organizations that hold events with really impressive speakers. This is the key. So I volunteered for SVACE, and because most volunteers feel like they can do a mediocre job since they're not getting paid, it gives you a very easy opportunity, just a softball pitch, to make yourself stand out as awesome. So you, number one, do what you're going to say when you say you're going to do it. Number two, you take on other responsibility. So you go to the person who's managing you as a volunteer and you're like, I think I could also help with this and this. Would you like me to do that? And I would do that with very menial things, so that I showed things were not sort of beneath my pay grade, which was zero, obviously. So it's like if I saw that, hey, the iced tea ran out, and that's the job of food services, but it's not getting done, I would run interference, or not interference, I would sort of quarterback that to get done. And eventually I got to the point, and this only took a month or two, which in the grand scheme of your life is not a ton of time, especially if you're only doing this a couple hours a week, got to the point where I was able to volunteer to spearhead an entire major event. And that meant that we were going to invite 400 to 500 people, and I would be in charge of inviting the speakers and coordinating the speakers. And that gave me a chance to get to basically invite all of the icons I wanted to meet.
Then impress them.
And then make a strong impression, positive impression, when I met them. And that included people like the creator of the Pet Rock. I think he was at the last minute, had health trouble and wasn't able to come. Founder of Clif Bar, and I think he sent one of his SVPs. So you don't always get what you want. Ed Bird, who commercialized, was one of the guys who first commercialized creatine monohydrate. Really knows the supplement world. And then Trip Hawkins, co-founder of Electronic Arts, and Jack Canfield, co-creator of Chicken Soup for the Soul. And years later, Jack was the person who introduced me to a superstar editor who had just become a book agent. And Steve was the one who took out my book and fought for the 4-hour work week, despite the fact that it was turned down by 27 publishers. That is a very easy approach. And in almost every major city or even minor city in the U.S., there are chapters of the Entrepreneurs Organization, the EO. Go volunteer at one of these events.
Yeah.
Get to know the speakers. Don't act entitled. Nobody owes you anything. Do the jobs that no one else will do. And it doesn't take very long.
We're going to get to career strategy in a bit. I have one of your favorite questions for you. But I do want to ask this idea. When have you felt most proud and or slash fulfilled in your life?
My life. That's a biggie.
Or what comes to mind?
The first thing that comes to mind, honestly, and this may seem trivial, but it's not to me, is because I could say there were two things that came to mind, and these are two conflicting in a way moments. So the first was, you know, after fighting this fight and getting the 4-hour work week published, there were only 12,000 copies originally printed, which is not even enough to get full national distribution in one major chain. And I remember the day that my editor called me, and it was after a long day of doing back-to-back radio satellite tours, where you just do, you know, like 40 radio interviews in a day and drink way too much coffee and feel miserable at the end. And that's okay, because I like to batch things like that so I get them done with. And she called and she said, hey, congratulations, Mr. New York Times bestselling author. And I was like, Heather, don't fuck with me, please. I'm way too tired. And she goes, no, I just got a preview of the list, and you are on the extended list for the New York Times. And I was just like, and I just like fell against the wall and slid down. So I was sitting on the floor with kind of like my head in my hands, and I just would just like couldn't talk for a pretty good period of time. And so that was a memorable moment. But the first thing that jumped to mind, and I was like, oh, that seems so trivial, I shouldn't say that, is whenever I get a tweet from someone or a Facebook message that says something along the lines of, just wanted to let you know I've lost 120 pounds on the slow carb diet, and I've been able to get off of all of my medications. Here's a pic, before and after. Those are what keep me writing, because I don't write my material for people to read my material. I write my material to have people act on the information. And I never planned on being a writer. I always thought I was going to be a teacher. So I actually thought I was going to end up teaching ninth grade specifically, because I think that's a very, it's a super critical year in which people choose forks in the road that take them to, say, not going to college and getting a mediocre job, or really going for the gold, picking mentors for themselves and doing great things. Not to say you need to go to college right. to do great things. You can go both ways. But I always thought I was going to end up teaching, and mm-hmm. I ended up guest lecturing at Princeton, where I did my undergrad in high tech entrepreneurship for a few years. And those were the notes that formed the basis for the 4-hour work week. Wow. And I had a snarky Princeton student, because that's what Princeton yeah. students do, say, "I don't know. I don't understand why you're teaching a class of, you know, 30 students. Why don't you just write a book and be done with it?" And that wasn't a real recommendation. It was just a dickish comment. And
you were like, huh.
Well, I just stuck in my head. And then I had really bad insomnia at the time. So I would, just to go to sleep, I would have these chapter ideas or conceptual ideas for like where I would put a certain anecdote or story or takeaway. And I was like, you know what? I'm never going to write a book. I don't want to write. You know, I wrote my senior thesis in college and it almost killed me. I took a year off, in fact, because it was so stressful for me. I have no desire to write. But I kept on taking these notes and putting these things down just to get to sleep, and then it came to be. But it's always the feedback from readers who have made a change and had a tremendous result, or just a really encouraging result, if that makes sense. So people are like, "I always thought I was bad at languages. I gave up in Spanish in 10th grade, and you know, now I'm taking my first trip ever to, you know, Germany, and I'm using Duolingo, and I've made a ton of progress, and I negotiated a remote work agreement so that I can work for the, you know, the few days a week for the 3 weeks that I'm in Germany, and it's the first time I've taken a trip overseas." And I'm just like, well, fucking A. Like,
yeah.
I will write more because of that.
No, I can relate 100%, and I'm going to get to a point here. With Product Hunt, when the money from Andreessen for Series A came in the bank, and even if that had been a 100x multiple, you know, I was so excited, but it doesn't compare to the stories you hear of people who say, "Hey, you know, you launched my baby, and now I'm doing something I'm really passionate about. I quit my job," and that's amazing. But I want to take this a step further in that my answer would, and I don't know if other people are like this. I had a girlfriend at the time who made me a bookshelf with my favorite quotes on it from all these authors.
Oh, that's cool.
And I felt that was like, oh my God, I was worthy of this kind of individual, specific love. And one thing I think about, and I'm curious your thoughts on, is this tension between, and not that these are exclusive anyway, being loved specifically. Jonathan Francis has a theory about this, versus being loved by the masses. And how do you balance this tension of being someone's everything, if that's important to you, or being there for even one person, or having the deepest relationship you can have with one person, and the kind of the tension that comes with you know, the expectations that come with having a community and an audience that you are extremely impactful for, but not necessarily their specific one person. What do you think about that?
I've thought a lot about this. There are a few things. Number one, I was told quite a few years ago, you're never as good as they say you are, and you're never as bad as they say you are. And that's just a really good, it's a really good maxim to keep in mind, because it's easy to get down on yourself. Say if you get, I remember, for instance, I was featured on the cover of the travel section of the New York Times, and I talked about how some of my friends who are photographers will put starter pistols that don't fire any ammo in their suitcases with tens of thousands of dollars of photography equipment, because they have to declare it as a firearm, and their luggage never gets misplaced. And Frank Bruni got really just worked up into a tizzy and wrote a piece in the New York Times that attacked me and went all over the place. People thought it was an Onion article. It was all over the map. But it really just threw me into a bit of a funk. And I'd like to say I'm invulnerable to that, but I'm not. And so in moments like that, it's like, look, you're never as bad as they say you are, but also, You're never as good as they say you are either, so don't get your head inflated. So when it comes to interacting with people I don't really know, like journalists or the masses, I try to keep that in mind. Yeah, I did end up came to me after a few glasses of wine. I took, just like people will take long reviews for movies, and then they'll be like, exhilarating, .. amazing,
yeah,
and they'll excerpt. So I took, there was a line out of his article, which was something like, Tim Ferriss walks on water and air. And there's more to it, obviously, but I took that, and that became an inside cover quote for the 4-Hour Chef.
And he was being sarcastic, or he was
being... He's being totally sarcastic.
Yeah.
But ultimately, we have to, I think, decide on the hierarchy of the value of different relationships. And I've tried very hard in the last 1 or 2 years in particular to spend more time calling my parents, talking to my brother, going home and spending time with my parents, and realizing that, you know, you don't have an indefinite period of time to say the things that you should say. You don't have an indefinite period of time or guaranteed stretch of time to do the things that someday you think you should do. And for me, that has meant a constriction, sort of like the white dwarf miniaturization of my relationships. I'm trying to go from a lot of loose relationships, which at some point can be helpful, to a handful of really critical close relationships that I can foster and focus on. And I think part of that maybe is just getting a little older. I'm 37, mm-hmm. and I feel like the loose ties, startup, heads down, living on Red Bull and sleeping under desks and eating ramen, that is it's a young man's game or a young woman's right. game. You know what I mean? I feel like it's like professional sports. I mean, I really feel like the startup world is a full contact sport, and at the highest level, you are burning yourself out and pushing yourself like a professional athlete. And there are certain age brackets that make that easier than others.
Yeah.
They're always outliers, right? Mm-hmm. People talk about time management, and I think people associate me with time management, but attention and energy management is more important than mm-hmm. time management. And you have to decide how you're going to allocate those resources very carefully. And I'll give right. you an example. If you check email on, say, a Saturday morning, but you don't actually want to do any work until Monday morning, but you're like, you wake up, you don't have any plans for Saturday, so you're like, I'll just check email really quickly, and you find a bunch of problems and crises, or even maybe just a semi-insulting email in the way that you read it, and you can't do anything about it until Monday, your weekend's worthless.
Right.
You have the time, but you're preoccupied, and if your mind is occupied, you can't appreciate or experience anything truly that's put in front of you. So those are a couple of maybe random yeah. thoughts, but that's generally how I've been viewing these things.
And with screen-free Saturdays, I'm with you. Do you think it's harder to have deeper, focused? So perfect example. You talk about athletes. There's an article in Kobe Bryant just came out recently where he interviewed with him. He says it's hard for him to have best friends only like minds because he's just so obsessed in what he's doing. And the way he talked about it was like, I'm not gonna call someone and wish them happy birthday. Like, that's just not something that crosses Kobe Bryant's mind. And so this concept of when you're so obsessed in what you're doing and you have such an audience and you have all these distractions, which, you know, are amazing. You know, you change people's lives in a mass way. Is it harder to have specific best friendships or romantic relationships?
I don't think so. I used to think so.
How do you think about that?
I used to think that was true, that they were mutually exclusive, and I don't think so. I think that was a disabling belief that was not an accurate reflection of objective reality. I think it was a reflection of my reality because I believed that, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, as we believe, so we create, and right. so we act. But I would say my healthiest long-term relationships that I've had have all been in the last 10 years.
Wow.
And that is by engineering. You have to make – it doesn't just happen, I don't think. Maybe for other people, but it's not – a miracle that manifests itself in my case, because I am hardwired, even though I wrote the 4-hour work week and everything else, as I point out in the book, like once a workaholic, always workaholic. It's right. like you are, if you have that type A competitive hardwiring and you fucking hate losing, however you define that, you are going to default to working if you have a void. Yeah. And so for me, I have to create constraints and routines, like you mentioned, screen-free Saturdays yep. where I don't look at laptops or computers. The most important change or mind shift, I think, as it relates to friendship for me has been, so Kobe Bryant said he's not going to call people and say happy birthday. The way I would tweak that is I would say I don't want close friends who require me yeah. to call them to say happy birthday. In other words, and I will if I remember. Look, and I do that, and I like getting reminders via Skype yeah. and so on. They're like, hey, so-and-so's birthday. And I'm like, oh, yeah. shit, I should really yeah. point that out. But I want high intimacy, low maintenance relationships.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So if I, for instance, we mentioned Josh Waitzkin. He's one of my closest friends. And if we're both jamming on our own stuff and we're just in the zone and we don't talk for 3 months, we pick up the phone and talk, it's like we just talked to each other 15 minutes before the phone call. It's yeah. the ball hasn't been dropped. There are no hurt feelings. there are points at which you have to divorce yourself from certain friends. And I hate to say that because it sounds callous, but it's true. Like, you get to a point, and let's be fair. I mean, when I was just getting started, I remember, and I'm not going to name names, but I sent my book proposal to a number of authors I really respected, and a few of them didn't reply, or they sent back what I took as sort of like abrasive, curt responses. And now I'm like, I get it. And the fact that I was so miffed and took that personally is ridiculous, mm-hmm. because I had no conception. I was like, but I'm really busy. And if you're not, you know, how could you be busier? I'm like, trust me, they are busier. And it's hard to fathom what people at the top of their game, and I'm not saying that's me, but it's really hard to fathom what they contend with on a daily basis. And so I think that trying to be a better friend myself to people and not take things personally, you know, there's an expression that I'll modify slightly that I've also found very helpful, right? So you're never as good and never as bad as they say you are, but also never attribute to malice what can be explained by incompetence or just being busy, right? It's like I get, you know, my assistants and I get, and this is partially because I've had information leaked, or blind CCs are like the bane of my existence. Right. Never fucking blind intro people who are busy to anyone else. Ask first. And if you're too lazy to do that, then you should slap yourself in the face. You make a lot of enemies by making blind intros. You know, we get 1,000 plus email a day. Mm-hmm. And I'll have some, like I had a guy come up to me literally 2 days ago, and I was, you know, walking through the mission, just chilling. I was on a phone call also, like I was talking to a friend. And he walked up and he's like, hey, I sent you an email and you didn't respond. And I'm just like, what? How do you expect me to reply to that? Like, the way that you just conducted yourself means I can never recommend you to anyone. Mm-hmm. Because what if your email is like, hey, here's this awesome thing, great idea, can you introduce me to your friend? And I'll be like, this is the guy who just walked up to me and said, yo, I emailed you and you didn't respond. I'm not going to run the risk of damaging my reputation by introducing this person to anyone. Very roundabout way of saying that I'm trying to focus on high intimacy, low maintenance relationships. And sadly, you know, the way that, you know, like Kobe said, he's looking for like minds. Sadly, there are points at which it is easier to choose people who have experienced a similar reality to your own.
Yeah.
Because it's hard to even imagine. It's like, look, I get death threats from crazy people.
Yeah.
And it's like, your audience is big enough. 1 out of every 1,000 is going to be batshit crazy. And it's like, I get death threats and crazy people. There are folks out there, I'm not making this up, who thought I was talking to them privately through coded Facebook messages, and they were going to come work for me and fly to California. I mean, like, dangerous, creepy stuff. And if someone hasn't experienced that or knows someone who's experienced that, it's very hard for them to understand when I'm like, hey, could you please never give my cell phone to anyone? And they're like, what a dick. Who does he think he is? You know, Prince Charles? And it's like, no, I don't. But you haven't experienced the craziness that I have.
And it's lonely at the top sometimes, or scary at the top. No one feels bad for them, you know?
No, and look, it's like, I get it, right? Yeah. These are on Maslow's hierarchy of needs. These are high-level problems. Yeah. Like shelter, food, all of that is taken care of. But it's easy for people to have no sympathy for, like, Brad Pitt. They're like, oh, he's on the cover of magazines, and like people are taking photographs of his children when he's trying to go to the park with them. Boo hoo. And it's like, well, no, actually, you should try to become more empathic. So I think one of the side benefits of meditating, for instance, is which I've only been doing consistently with spectacular payoff for the last year or so, mostly transcendental meditation, is that you can do types of meditation that are specifically compassion meditation or empathy meditation.
Yeah.
And for someone who is inherently very impatient, I've been this way since I was a little kid, that is really important, because when I get upset with someone or snap at them, it is very easy to prevent if I take a moment to ask myself what might be going on in their life.
Right.
Right. And I'm sure everyone's had the experience of being like, dude, what the fuck? And blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, sorry, like my aunt died last night.
Yeah.
And then you feel like an asshole. And it's like, well, maybe you should just assume that they have a good reason and ask some questions instead of snapping. This quote,
everyone's fighting a battle you know nothing about.
Yeah, that's a great quote. Yeah. I'm going to borrow that one. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great one. Everyone's fighting a battle you know nothing about. So true. So I'm not sure how I got to that point, but it's These are a lot of things I think about, but for me, it's like the more tenuous relationships and shallow relationships that I have, shallow is a bad word, just loose ties.
Yep.
The greater the liability. It's a numbers game for me. It's like the greater the probability that someone's not going to think and make a blind intro, and then that person's going to be like, cool, great. Yeah. I'm CCing the rest of my team, and now 8 people have my email address. And then someone's like, hey, sorry to bother you, but I want to introduce you to my brother. He lost 20 pounds in your book. And then the brother's like, cool, I'm CCing my wife. And then I have to change my email address, you know?
And it's funny, you talk about, you know, time management, and from that to kind of attention, energy management. One thing you've also talked about in the podcast is success management. And this concept of, you know, and I think about it as someone who's up and coming, how, you know, the more audience you have, one, you can impact a lot of people, and two, the more kind of just tool you have at your disposal to invest in the things you want to invest in, do the things you want to do, but it can come with a lot of stress. You know, one in every thousand is batshit crazy, these expectations that you have to keep putting out content or you know, or like what's going on, you know, that you owe them something. And a lot of people, you know, authors, artists, entertainers, a lot of people have this. How do you think about this kind of success management, especially as you get older, as you think about, you know, maybe you want to have a family or start focusing on other things? How do you think about that?
There are a few things that can be helpful or that I've found helpful myself. Number one is remembering why you did it in the first place and making sure that you haven't deviated too far from that path, if it's still true for you, right? So the 4-hour work week, great point. Like I still believe, I'd have to maybe go reread, but I think I still believe everything in that book, and I still use almost everything in that book. So for me, it's like if I'm feeling overwhelmed, I have to ask myself, why am I feeling overwhelmed? Let me do an 80-20 analysis and look at the 20% of people, activities, commitments that are creating 80% of my negative emotions and stress. And then I can really sit down, and I do this every 4 to 8 weeks. I mean, I'll sit down with a pad of paper and do this, and then identify what I need to cancel, reschedule, or fill in the blank. And what was very helpful for me, quite frankly, so success management, I would say, is just realizing you have a choice. Mm-hmm. And people are like, I'm so busy. It's like, well, you're busy because you made certain decisions.
Right.
You can make different decisions, right? They're just, in some cases, uncomfortable decisions. For instance, I am right now trying to, and I shouldn't even use the word try, but I'm trying to take what I would call a startup vacation. I'm focused on this massive launch of this TV show, mm-hmm. with content that you're asking about proud. Like, I'm so proud of this show. I think it's great. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we really got an amazing team together with like Emmy Award winning shooters and everything. Yet, I still find it hard to say no to, say, the VC who's like, hey, CCing, so and so CEO, we're investing in the seed round. We'd love to have you involved. And there's this, I feel like there will be this social punishment, or I will be ostracized, or there's the FOMO, right? The fear of missing out. Like, well, what if I miss the next big deal? And what you have to answer is, what if that doesn't matter, right? That's the better question.
Right.
And for me, it's like I've been very fortunate to invest and advise a couple of, you know, really skyrocketing companies, and you managing any type of growth in your career or in your life, because things can grow out of control, and they do very quickly. So I think that you need to, number one, realize that to get the huge positive things done, you have to say no to 1,000 things that are kind of cool. Super important. And that, you know, if you talk to or read Warren Buffett's annual letters, one of his expressions, and I'm paraphrasing here, but is that the difference between people who get good results and the people who get great results is people who get great results say no to almost everything. And with that, realizing, using, say, startups as an example, you can get a lot of things wrong as long as you get just a few things right. Mm-hmm. You do not have to invest in every next Snapchat, next Uber, next whatever the hell. If you invest in one of those, you're set for fucking life. Like, you don't have to hit a home run every time you're at bat. I mean, Babe Ruth, I think, also had the strikeout record. Mm-hmm. A lot of people gloss over that. So realizing, it's like, if I take, and this is a question I ask myself a lot also, is, for instance, because I've had people advise against me taking a startup vacation, right? People who are in the startup game, they're like, dude, people are going to stop sending you deals, you're going to lose your deal flow, do not make any kind of public announcement that you're taking a startup vacation, which I wanted to do to keep myself accountable.
Right.
And then I have to ask myself, okay, let's assume that that's true for a second. If that's true, what does my life look like a year from now? Does this behavior scale? Right? What does my life look like 2 years from now? Is it better or worse than where I am now? And very similar to, say, email, right? If you're like emails piling up and you feel like you don't have time to set up systems. Well, it's like, okay, if you don't have time to set up systems, what is this going to look like in 6 months, in a year? What long-term pain are you guaranteeing by not saying no for half a day to do some short-term work? And so those are a handful of questions that I ask myself constantly.
Yeah.
And if hypothetically the startup game is one that requires me to be at the beck and call of replying to email 24/7 to people I only half know who introduce me to someone I don't know at all, is that really a life that I want for myself?
Right.
And the answer is no. But that's also based on the assumption that I have to do that, and I don't think that's true because there are too many counterexamples.
And let's keep that theme of looking at your life in years out, and that's maybe 10 to 15 years out. With the concept of – you were talking about best friendships and Josh Waitzkin, I can relate to this idea of, you know, you have similar values, and almost the best way Josh can be a friend to you is pursuing what he's passionate about, because then he's growing and then you're learning and you see him succeed and you're inspired and empowered. But one thing I wonder for myself is, as I pursue his best friendship, does that mean that no one relies on me or that I'm not relying on someone else? And is that important? And also, you have this quote in the background, I think Kofi or someone at the UN said that it's easier to give yourself to the masses than it is to dedicate yourself, like repair your relationship with your brother. And going back to our parents for a second, I could tell my mom I love her, and I do, but improving that relationship is hard. It's easier to do the stuff that I'm already doing.
It's definitely harder,
yeah,
because your closest friends and your family, they are familiar with your bullshit, and
yeah,
they know too much. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
They know too much to take you too seriously.
Right.
Whereas I think when you have a large audience, and I just want to come back to one thing you said.
Right.
You said, you know, when you have a large audience, you have these opportunities. And in my mind, you also have a huge obligation. So,
right,
you know, with great audience comes great responsibility, because you can hurt people.
Yeah.
It's a knife that can cut both ways. You say something indiscriminately and you don't realize, like, all right, like 10 out of or 100 out of 1,000 people aren't going to read your directions.
Yeah.
So that's the reason why, for instance, you know, I had David Blaine teach me how to hold my breath and pulled off some pretty amazing stuff, but I took that out of the 4-hour body because the downside, the risk of people not following the directions was death. And I was like, all right, I have to take that out.
As you think about the next 10 to 15 years of your life, are you looking for kind of a life partner that way?
Well, a life partner, now you and I have talked about this. Life partner is a sticky question.
Yeah.
I'll put it this way. I am, for the first time in my entire life, I'm starting to ask questions about marriage and kids.
Mm.
Besides, how should I get married and have kids?
Mm.
Because as I've grown older, I'm 37 now, and the vast majority of the marriages that my friends have are blowing apart at the seams.
Mm-hmm.
And kids only add pressure to that. So if you have any cracks in your relationship, in that vessel, kids are just going to make it explode. They're not going to repair anything. And but if I had to look at it, I would say I'm more confident in my ability to be a good dad than in my ability to be the perfect husband. And I can do monogamy. But it really forces me to kill and suffocate a part of myself that is very essential for other areas of my life. And I can do it. I've been an excellent, I do not cheat, and I've been a very good boyfriend that way. But can I do that for 10 years? Can I do that for 15, 20? I am extremely skeptical.
Yeah.
And but is there an alternative? Is there an alternative situation, an agreement that works? And this is going to sound terrible, but it's like I'm too aggressive and bull-like to, at this point in my life, and there are some people in the poly community that might be like, oh my God, he needs to evolve. We're so highly evolved. I'm just not okay with a two-way street. Like I can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So where does that leave me? I don't know.
Right.
You know? It's like, it'd be great if I could have a girlfriend, wife who's down to have like threesomes all the time with other women, but I'm not cool with having the sword fighting. on right. every other Tuesday. Like, I'm not down for that. So what's the solution? And the answer is, I don't know. Short term, I just need to get a dog so I have a constant companion. I think I need man's best friend. And that, hopefully that'll address some of my, like, emotional needs so that I can think about all of this stuff in a more rational way that isn't driven by testosterone alone. But I do think of life partners in friendships, though.
Right.
You need to find people who will call you on your bullshit. You need to find people who will have the hard conversations, right? And people who don't – who feel like they are able to come to you with that and not be afraid or overly nervous. But it's like, okay, like, we're going to have – we're going to sit down, have some food, maybe have a couple drinks. And it's like, dude, you are fucking up. Like, we need to talk about this, this, and this. We're worried about you. And, like, they don't hesitate for a second to have those types of conversations. It's right. hard to find people like that.
What do you want to be known for when we look out at the, you know, 20 years longer? What do you want your legacy to be?
First thing that would come to mind is the teacher who wanted his students to all be better than himself. I mean, I want to create thousands or millions of world-class learners who are capable of learning things many times faster than I was ever capable of, who can then teach other people the same thing. I think that would be it.
This might seem like a strange question, but can you outline your funeral for me as you imagine it?
Honestly, I would want it to be more like funerals that I've seen or heard of in other cultures, where it's I don't want it to be a black suit, somber event. I want it to be a party.
Yeah.
You know? And, like, I remember, I think it was the founder of judo, Jigoro Kano, who is just an incredible human being, an amazing martial artist on top of everything, of course. But I'm pretty sure he was buried in a white belt to signify beginner's mind.
Wow.
And I'm not asking to be buried in, like, a karate outfit with a or a judo outfit with a white belt on, but I do like the idea of forcing people to have a party in some way that encourages them to express how grateful they are, not for anything I did, but just for things in their lives, and use it as a real kind of wake-up call for people who aren't yet dead. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And but just to have, like, some absurd – I mean, I have no idea. Maybe I'd have, like – jugglers and comedians, but I would want it to be like I would want it to be a party.
Cool. So some questions for the audience I want to make sure to bring in. Well, first, high level, and this brings it full circle, you've thought about, you know, this show. You've, you know, written 3 bestsellers. You've invested in some amazing world-class startups. You've amassed a huge audience. One thing I keep hearing you come back to is kind of this domino theory that you want to do bunch of different you have a bunch of dominoes you want to knock over. Which one do you knock over first that makes every other one easier?
Yeah.
Explain that theory a little bit. And what's the calculus for pursuing the show out of all the other things you could pursue? And what domino are you knocking down? So what other dominoes remain that you want to knock down?
Sure. So the lead domino idea, and I'm glad you asked about this because I've had a couple of readers ask for clarification. So by the lead domino, all I mean is, of your list of 5 things that you could be dedicating your time to, or 10 things, or 100 things, depending on how out of control your mind is, like mine, what is the one thing you could do that would make all of the others either irrelevant or much easier to do? And that's the lead domino, right? So, and you could phrase it different ways. What's the force multiplier?
Right.
What is the Archimedes lever that makes everything else easier? And for me, the TV show checked a lot of boxes because, first and foremost, I wanted to have fun in the process even if it didn't succeed. And I did have fun. It was a little physically punishing, and people get to see a lot of faceplants and some really dangerous accidents with, like, parkour. Oh, my God. And rally car racing. Yeah, watch out. There are, like, trees on either side of a dirt path that's like 8 to 10 feet wide. Yeah, things can go wrong. But I did have a lot of fun. I wanted to do something that was, this is going to sound funny, but not just purely pragmatic, but artistic at the same time. And got such an incredible team together. I mean, like, the motion graphics, you guys will see. It's solid. And I mean, we have super slow-mo for like the tactical shooting episode where I compete against Kevin Rose. And we had a special camera that this huge rig that recorded, I think, 10,000 frames per second. So you can watch shotgun, you can watch like payloads coming out of shotguns and like splitting in midair. It's insane. But on top of that, I feel like the visual medium is a very viscerally impactful medium that you can use as a Trojan horse. So the intention of my books is to use stories and funny anecdotes and self-experiments to sugarcoat something very important that I want people to act on. But you can't just give them the prescription. You have to give them the entertainment. And the TV show, I think, is just the epitome of that. I mean, you have so much packed into short form where people aren't necessarily going to sit down and read a 600-page book or 400-page book. You have these accelerated learning tools that have embedded like Easter eggs into each of these episodes. So if you watch, and the entire season is going to be available at once, all 13 episodes with a bunch of bonus footage and extended scenes on iTunes. If you watch that season, even a handful of the episodes, like you will have a toolkit for learning anything that has been field tested by me, other students that I take through the process, as well as demonstrated by people like Laird Hamilton of, you know, the undisputed king of big wave surfing, or the Marcelo Garcias, or, you know, Urban Escape and Evasion. So there's the there's a heavy Jason Bourne, James Bond element to it as well.
And it really, it's another way of you being doing what you do, which is teach, you know, by example, by entertainment. And the what you're teaching is that you can learn whatever it is you want to learn, and you can learn it probably faster than you think, better than you think, bigger than you think, no matter who you are.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you want superhuman results, you don't have to have superhuman genetics or an unending budget. You just need a better toolkit, handful of questions that you can ask, handful of ways that you can look at, say, how you might go about learning the guitar or Spanish or anything. Poker, professional poker was another episode. And know immediately, you know, within 5 or 10 minutes, how you can go about it to learn twice as quickly. And that's fun. You know, that is fun for me. And I think it will also open people up to looking at my other content that's already been put out.
Yeah.
But the TV show is definitely self-sufficient. And the easiest way to find it is just to go to either it's the Tim Ferriss Experiment, and you can find it on iTunes, iTunes.com/Tim Ferriss, 2 R's, 2 S's. And you can also find a bunch of bonuses and extras and so on at 4hourworkweek.com/TV, all spelled out.
Cool. And the last Q, and I'll let you get out, is, and you can say this in one sentence, what would you tell your 22-year-old self?
All right, I'll keep this short, but it's a couple things. So I would say, number one is work for a fast-growing company of, say, 15 to 50 people where you can work directly with or observe the main deal makers in the company and learn how to negotiate on someone else's dime. And there's some really good books for that, actually. Getting Past No, it's better than Getting to Yes, in my opinion, more realistic. And then Secrets of Power Negotiating by Dawson. So that'd be number one. Number two would be volunteer in organizations where you can have contact with, very similar, master deal makers and creators. And because that is a way, when you have nothing to offer, that is one of the few ways where you can have intimate, direct contact and conversations with those people that you will not be able to get access to otherwise, even as a recent graduate. And then number three, I would say, don't fucking forget to exercise. Because that allows you to operate at such a higher level and is such an incredibly valuable stress reducer. Just do not forget to schedule your exercise in your calendar in the same way that you would schedule everything else.
Perfect. Tim, thank you so much. Our audience has been wanting this for such a long time. They're big fans of the podcast as well. And this would be awesome. Maybe part two in the next phase. The show is going to be incredible, and it's going to launch the day the show launches, and we're all going to blow it up.
Awesome. Yeah, can't wait, man. I'll come back anytime.
Cool. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks.